Welcome to Talking History. This is your host, Brian LeBeau of Creighton University's Department of History. Spring has sprung, and so have the tulips, adding a delightful splash of color to the landscape. But tulips are more than just another pretty flower, as you will learn this week when Talking History's Eileen Dugan chats with Mike Dash, author of Tulipomania. But before we get to that, let's take a look at an event that occurred this week in history. In 1804, two men embarked on one of the greatest expeditions in American history. Captain Meriwether Lewis and Lieutenant William Clark started up the Missouri River from St. Louis on the first leg of their overland journey to the Pacific coast as part of President Thomas Jefferson's initiative to explore the newly acquired Louisiana Purchase. During the nearly three-year expedition to the Pacific Ocean and back, approximately 40 men employed their outdoor training and skills in botany, meteorology, zoology, celestial navigation, Indian sign language, and boat handling, not only to survive but also to collect and record valuable information on the area and its inhabitants, as well as to debunk the myth of an all-water route through the continent known as the Northwest Passage. Under Lewis and Clark's leadership, the expedition was able to make the difficult ascent up the Missouri River to North Dakota, to cross the formidable Continental Divide, to arrive by canoe at the mouth of the Columbia River along the Pacific coast, and to return to St. Louis on September 23, 1806. Miraculously, despite their encountering many hostile Indians and animals and experiencing sickness, exposure to extremes of heat and cold, and near starvation, only one member of the group died. Turning to items of historical interest in the news, the first lesson at the Gladiator School of the Roman Historical Society stresses discipline. You are slaves, and that is how I will treat you, barks Giuseppe Coluzzi at his adult students fidgeting in short white togas. Coluzzi glares at them and insists that they address him with Hail Teacher, in Latin, of course, and that they never use their swords outside the arena without a master present. A few snickers might be heard, but mostly the students who sign up to learn how to fight to the death listen raptly through 2 hours of gladiator history and combat theory. I've always been a Roman history buff, but I want to relive it more intensely, one employee of a German multinational corporation in Rome comments. It's one thing to read histories. I want to get in touch with my warrior side. Students pay $100 for the two-month course. Archaeologists have excavated the hull of a boat fit for an ancient Egyptian king's eternal journey in the afterlife. The 5,000-year-old wood hull is the earliest surviving example of a built boat, one constructed of planks fitted together and representing a major advance in boat-building technology over the dugout logs and reed vessels of more ancient vintage. The boat was found about 300 miles south of Cairo near the burial places of some of the earliest Egyptian pharaohs. This is Talking History.
A spray of tulips and heather tied up together, I sent my love today. A spray of tulips and heather, asking her whether love's dream had gone astray.
I suppose there must be one or two people in the world who choose not to like tulips, but surely no more. However, there are those who have loved tulips in history for reasons other than their beauty. Indeed, nearly four centuries ago, there was a mania for them. Talking History's Eileen Dugan talks with Mike Dash about what drove people mad for tulips.
Here in Nebraska, I know it's spring when my tulips start to appear in my garden. I have several dozen of them, early bloomers, late bloomers, and I take great pleasure in them. Who would have imagined that, nearly 400 years ago, my modest assortment of common flowers might have been worth a king's ransom? But so it was in Holland in the 1630s, when wild financial speculation drove the cost of a single bulb to astronomical levels. It was what historians would come to call tulipomania. With us today to discuss the tulip craze of the 1630s and its eventual crash is Dr. Mike Dash, author of Tulipomania, the story of the world's most coveted flower and the passions it aroused. Welcome, Dr. Dash.
Hello.
What are the origins of the tulip, actually?
Well, it isn't a Dutch flower, which many people assume it must be, given the strength that the Netherlands currently holds in the bulb production stakes. It actually comes from the vastness of Central Asia. It was originally grown or either grew wild in the valleys of the Tian Shan Mountains in the Pamir Range, which are on the border of Russia, China, and Tibet, and in one of the most inhospitable and inaccessible places on Earth, in fact. And from there, the tulip actually spread largely naturally, but partly carried by man, westwards, so that around about the 10th or 11th century, it comes into view for the first time, and by that point, it was available throughout Central and Near Asia, all the way through to the Black Sea and parts of what are now Turkey.
And how did the tulip come to the West?
Well, originally it was cultivated at first by the Persians and the Ottoman Turks in the period of around about 900 or 1000 through to 1500. And they were the first people to plant tulip bulbs in gardens and also to begin to breed what we would call sort of modern tulip varieties. This was a very haphazard business at the time because the way in which tulips propagate and develop new varieties was very, very poorly, if at all, understood. And various techniques would have been tried along the lines of pouring sort of dark red wine over the roots of the flower in an attempt to make it bloom in a more sort of violet colour the next year, that type of thing. Now, at the time, the Turks particularly were a major power, and certainly around about the 16th century, they were the fear of all of Europe, really. And in consequence, a large number of European ambassadors, mercenary troops, soldiers, and so on, were passing through the Ottoman Empire for various reasons. And they occasionally came across tulip bulbs, and some of those then found their way back in the packages of these people to Central Europe, where, in fact, the tulip began to appear around about 1550 in the lands of the Holy Roman Empire. Some of the first flowers that we know about were being grown in southern Bavaria in around about 1555. And from there on, it spread slowly through Europe, so that around about 1600, it was being grown quite widely in France and the Netherlands as well. And from that very modest base, the Dutch gradually developed the modern tulip industry as we know it today, but it certainly took them quite some time to do.
And how wide was the variety of tulip species available at that time?
Oh, it was very, very limited. I mean, at first, I mean, for example, if we take what happened in Holland, we know that around about 1570, the very first bulbs were being grown in Amsterdam. And at that point, the number of varieties available would have been perhaps, you know, two or three different sorts. And they would have been very simple flowers. They were unicolored tulips, all white petals, all red petals. What happened thereafter was really rather remarkable, and in a sense, one of the most remarkable things that ever happened to any flower, because the tulip actually at some point, perhaps in the 16th century, it's very difficult to say now, became infected with a sort of virus called the mosaic virus. And one of the effects that this virus had was to make the plant break, which is a technical term, which basically means that it started to flower in particularly vivid and beautiful colours. The colour actually was far stronger and brighter than was the case with other flowers available in the gardens at that time. And the patterns were extremely delicate. There would often be tulips with, for example, all white petals with very delicate flashes and flares of red or lilac colouring going up the centre of the petal and around the edges. And from all accounts, these tulips were in fact spectacularly beautiful, and this is really the reason that, why interest in tulips began to grow in a place like the Netherlands, which was at the turn of the 17th century just beginning to become the richest country in Europe as a result of the Dutch success in opening up the spice trade to the East Indies. And so gradually the gardeners who lived at that time were successful in developing a larger number of varieties, and obviously their aim at the same time was to make more and more beautiful flowers. So that by the time the tulip mania really began in earnest, which was in the 1630s, there would have been a couple of thousand varieties available in Central Europe. So that the growth in the number of flowers available was really very rapid. I mean, even now there are only about 5,000 different tulip varieties recognised. So in the Holland of the sort of 1600s, to move from a handful, a dozen at most, to over 1,000 in such a short space of time really does speak volumes for the efforts of the gardeners who were living at that time.
So why did the tulip, of all things, take the Dutch market by storm in the 1630s?
Well, it's hard to say in a sense. I mean, there are some very simple things one can say. I mean, it's hard perhaps to imagine one's way back to what it would have been like to live in that period. But one of the things that we do know, for example, is that, as I mentioned earlier, the Netherlands was a fantastically rich country. And a lot of the people at the very top end of the Dutch economy, the merchants and so on, were beginning to make use of sort of modern economic tools. They were, for example, at that time founded the first sort of modern banks, and it was possible to deal in stocks and shares if you were a rich Dutch merchant. But the people who were below that very exalted level had very little in the way of investment opportunities. There were very, very few, if any, banks available for people who didn't have literally fortunes to invest, and no opportunity to invest in a large way in stocks and shares unless you were fantastically wealthy. Similarly, there was nothing in the way of pensions or modern investment trusts and so on. So really, people had, well, they did have money, and there was a trickle-down effect in the Dutch economy, effectively, where although most of the money stayed in the hands of the rich merchants, obviously as spice money poured into the Netherlands in the early 17th century, people did become relatively better off than the inhabitants of other countries, and they were looking for things to do with their money, and obviously the choice is rather limited. You could stick it under your bed in an old sock, or you could try to find some way of investing. And tulip bulbs happened to be the medium which was basically selected by these sort of disenfranchised members of the Dutch economy, so to speak, as an investment vehicle. Essentially, the way that it happened was that to start with, in the sort of 1610s, 1620s, the tulip was really only being bought and sold by very, very rich connoisseurs, many of whom would have been merchants or members of the Dutch government at that time. And they were using the tulip bulbs really as a way of demonstrating their wealth, to be able to spend a large sum of money on something which only flowered for a couple of weeks in a year was a rather ostentatious thing to do. And also there was very much a vogue for sort of small beautiful items in the Dutch society of the Golden Age. And so the very rich Dutch merchants started to buy and sell the best tulip bulbs at really rather high prices. And slowly people caught on to this fact and began to realize that it was actually possible to make quite a large amount of money by dealing in these tulip bulbs. And compared to the normal ways of making money in the Netherlands at that time, which involved working sort of 16 or 17-hour days at some manual labor, the idea of just planting a few bulbs in the ground and waiting for them to flower and then selling them at a high price must have seemed very attractive. And so that really was the main spring for what became the tulip mania.
You talk about the rich and the powerful having taken part in the early phases of the tulip market, but then you also tell at the height of it the story of the orphans of, I want to say, Wouter Winkle and their participation in this. And can you tell us that story?
Well, yes. I mean, this is a classic example in the sense of just how fantastically wealthy tulips could make one at the absolute height of the tulip mania. Wouter Winkle was an innkeeper in a town called Alkmaar, which is in North Holland, north of Amsterdam. It's a sort of medium-sized town, and Winkle kept a tavern in the village, which at that time would have earned him normally sort of maybe 400 or 500 guilders in the course of a year. But quite early on in the craze of the tulips, he obviously saw this opportunity and started to deal in tulips. And so by 1635-36, he had acquired a rather unparalleled collection of bulbs of some of the most beautiful varieties, flowers such as Admiral van Enkhuizen and Admiral van der Eck, which were two of the most valuable bulbs in this period, and which could at the height of the mania sell for somewhere between 3,000 and 5,000 guilders a bulb. Now, it's important to realize that that is a gigantic amount of money, because in Holland at that time, one typically lived on perhaps 250 to 300 guilders a year. So a single bulb here, in other words, is being sold for somewhere around 12, 15, 20 times the annual salary of a typical manual worker, or in other words, for something like the value of a rather large house. Winkle's bulbs, he had about a couple of hundred of them at the peak of his career, were kept in a garden near his tavern. And what actually happened was that, rather unfortunately, in the summer of 1636, he died, leaving 6 or 7 children as orphans. His wife had died 2 or 3 years before that. And these children were taken into the custody of the town orphanage. And in order to raise money for them, the trustees of the orphans gathered up the tulip bulbs and held an auction in Alkmaar on the 5th of February in 1637. And this auction was actually the absolute peak of the tulip mania. It attracted, because of the excellence of the collection, it attracted some of the leading tulip dealers from the whole of Holland. And because it came at the end of a period where prices had been rising fantastically rapidly for several months, the prices that these bulbs reached were absolute peak prices. The entire collection, in fact, sold for a total of 90,000 guilders, which, even allowing for the fact that 7 children were involved, would have been enough to set each one of those children up for life. They were sort of aged 9 to 16, and had they actually been able to cash in on the bulbs fully, which it appears that perhaps they weren't, then they would really quite literally not have had to do another day's work in their entire lives.
So when we talk about the tulip craze in this period, can we call it a sort of futures market?
Well, there was definitely a futures market, and it was really one of the absolute first futures markets ever to develop. The future was really something which the Dutch invented, and it began to be possible to trade in futures stocks on the Amsterdam Stock Exchange not much earlier than about 1610, and really it came into play when you were talking about merchants who were investing in very highly risky voyages out to the East Indies as part of the spice trade to bring back nutmeg, cloves, peppers, and other luxury items which are in huge demand in Europe and very hard to get hold of. And the profits on these voyages could be huge. I mean, 400-500% was easily achievable. But equally, the risks were tremendous. And for a start, it took 2 years at least to go out to the East Indies and return with the cargo. And in that time, you could lose half of your crew to scurvy. You could be attacked by pirates or wrecked in a storm. Any number of things could happen. And so the Dutch began to start to sort of dispose of this risk, essentially, by selling what we would now call futures contracts. In other words, it became possible to actually arrange to buy part of a cargo of nutmeg, for example, at a fixed price, and you would pay the merchant who was planning to import this spice in advance, a small deposit, and when the cargo arrived, you would then fulfill your contract. You would buy it at the agreed price, no matter how high the price of nutmeg might have risen in Holland by that time, and therefore the merchant who was doing the importing sold some of the risk that the cargo might never arrive at all, and the person who bought the futures contract, if they read the market correctly, could potentially buy the spice at a tremendously low price relative to what it was actually worth at the time he would be able to sell it. Now, the tulip traders took some of these ideas and started to use it on tulip bulbs. So, essentially, in the early days, it became very difficult to keep the tulip market going over the whole year because the flowers were only visible for a few weeks in each spring, and it was not possible really to tell how well they would flower in between times. What then happened was that in order to maximized it, the way in which the tulip trade was growing, and also again to offset some of the risks, bulb dealers started to sell futures contracts in tulips. So you would say, I have a tulip in the ground, it weighed this much when I planted it, I would expect it to weigh a larger amount when it's finally lifted out of the ground again after flowering, because in the way of bulbs it will be producing offset small subsidiary bulbs which then themselves become valuable. And you would take a gamble that this might actually happen, that the bulb might produce two or three smaller bulbs, which you could then plant or sell yourself. And the futures trade in tulips, which began in around about 1634-35, was at the root of what became the tulip mania, because it became possible, owing to the system of paying simply a small deposit on each bulb, for people who couldn't normally afford the high prices that were being charged, to invest in one or two bulbs by paying, say, a 10% deposit, and then to sell on that bulb to somebody else before they would become liable to actually pay the balance when the bulb was lifted out of the ground. And a large number of people took advantage of this to build huge paper fortunes, which in many cases reached 30, 40, 50,000 guilders. What actually then happened, of course, at the end of the day, was that when the bulbs finally came to the point where they were due to be paid for, there was a substantial risk that a lot of these tulip traders who were not financially regulated in any way might begin to default on the various agreements they'd made. And the chain of ownership had become so protracted that the bulbs had been dealt so many times that it only took one of the owners of the bulb to default on their obligations for this extended chain to come crashing down, and for 10 or 15 different dealers to be affected by that. And that was what lay at the root of the tremendous crash in prices which came at the end of the tulip mania and happened in Holland around about February 1637. And which actually brought the whole bulb trade to an absolute halt in a very short space of time.
We only have a moment remaining, but do you see any relation between the story of tulipomania and the current explosion in the stock market, especially in internet stocks?
Well, I think that's a very fair parallel to draw in many ways. I mean, the thing about tulips, that, as they were dealt in Holland in the 1630s, was that, in essence, they were very indeterminate value. One or two of the most expensive bulbs did have a value to the wealthy merchants, the connoisseurs who bought and sold them, but the rest of the tulips really were not of any interest to anybody. No one was actually planning to plant and grow these flowers. That's the bizarre thing about it. And so they really had only a paper value and were more valuable as promissory notes than as bulbs. Now, the same sort of thing could certainly be applied to internet stocks, which are being dealt in the sense of people trying to make money from the rapid growth certainly up until very recently at least, was being seen with these stocks. But as we've seen perhaps just in the last week or two, there's a lot of doubt about the actual value of the internet stocks, as there is about the actual value of tulip bulbs in Holland in the 17th century. And once someone actually stops and asks the question, what is the real worth of this stock or the worth of this bulb, then it becomes rather difficult to maintain that the sort of high prices that were being charged for either tulips or internet stocks is actually something which has any sort of real value. And so the logic of the market reasserts itself, and in both the internet and the case of the tulip bulbs, a rapid decline in prices is fairly inevitable once someone starts asking those sort of simple questions.
Oh, well, thank you very much, Dr. Dash.
Thank you.
We have been talking with Dr. Mike Dash, author of Tulipomania, The Story of the World's Most Coveted Flower and the Passions It Aroused.
Tiptoe to the window, by the window, that is where I'll be. Come tiptoe through the tulips with me. Tiptoe from your pillow to the shadow of a willow tree, and tiptoe through the tulips with me.
When any new president assumes office, speculation begins as to what new policies he might implement, what new relations with foreign countries he might pursue, such is the case with President George Bush and Fidel Castro. Here to explore that possibility in some historical perspective is Stephen Allen, a writer for the History News Service.
Fidel Castro is not exactly welcoming the new president of the United States with open arms. In his first public comments after George W. Bush's inauguration, Castro said that he hoped Bush, quote, is not as stupid as he seems. There is one way that Bush could probably improve his image, not only in Castro's eyes, but in the eyes of millions worldwide. There is one way he could dispel some of the concern about his lack of foreign policy experience, one way he could make a mark on the world stage, normalize relations with Cuba. This may seem like a strange suggestion to make to a Republican president, since the Republicans have been much more vocal in their criticism of the Cuban government than the Democrats. The Cuban exile community in Florida has traditionally voted Republican. Even Castro seems to prefer dealing with the Democrats. He never criticized former President Bill Clinton as harshly as he has criticized President George W. Bush. The possibility of a U.S. reconciliation with Cuba seems as remote now as the possibility of a U.S. reconciliation with China seemed in 1972. The president in that year was also a Republican, and a man who had made his political reputation as a strident anti-communist, Richard Nixon. But Nixon surprised almost everybody by visiting China and meeting with its leaders. In many ways, Nixon was the perfect person to begin the process of restoring ties with China. He certainly could not be accused of being soft on communism. He first came to national attention as a congressional investigator of communism and communists. As president, he expanded and intensified the war against communist North Vietnam. His credentials in this respect were impeccable. In addition, Nixon's Republican Party was widely seen as taking a more unwavering stance against communism than the Democrats. But while the Republicans would have been eager to attack a Democrat who made overtures to China, they were reluctant to attack a president of their own party. This gave Nixon some room to maneuver without exposing himself to partisan attacks. George W. Bush has a similar advantage. If Clinton had tried to restore relations with Cuba, the Republican Party would have attacked him as courting a brutal communist dictatorship. Clinton, after all, opposed the war in Vietnam, had visited Russia in the 1970s, and had close ties to China, suspiciously close ties in the eyes of critics of his fundraising tactics. The Republicans could have claimed that Clinton was ignoring the plight of the Cuban people, and they probably would have been able to derail any overtures to Cuba on his part. If Bush tries to restore relations with Cuba, it would be difficult for the Republicans to attack him with the same fierceness. He is a fellow Republican, and sustained opposition to his policies would not be good for party unity. Also, Bush does not have the same political baggage that Clinton does. Like Nixon, he would have more room to maneuver without people second-guessing his motives. Last year, the United States gave China permanent most favored nation trade status. There's an American ambassador in Vietnam for the first time in decades. There has even been a recent thaw in relations with North Korea, a country with which the United States is technically still at war. Why not a reconciliation with Cuba?
You've been listening to Stephen Allen, an independent historian who writes for the History News Service. This is Talking History. Tulips, the subject of our interview this week are from Holland. So why not choose as our site of the week a place, in this case an exhibit, where you can learn more about the history of that country and its art. Here to tell you about that exhibit is Talking History's Cindy Workman.
If you are traveling to London this summer, make it a point to stop at the National Gallery to see the Vermeer and Delft School exhibition from June 20th through September 16th. Although the paintings of Johan Vermeer are often regarded as the culmination of realism in Dutch art, this exhibition reveals how earlier artistic development in Delft paved the way for achievements of Vermeer and his celebrated colleague, Pieter de Hooch. The exhibition focuses on the key decades of the 1650s and 60s. About a third of the paintings on view date from 50 years earlier. Along with the paintings, you will see tapestries and decorative arts, including cabinet bronzes and silver gilt, illustrating the high level of artistry attained by the Delft silversmiths.
Turning to our list of coming attractions, we have a number of interesting History Channel programs to call to your attention. A New World Order will provide an intimate account of the experience of war, in this case, World War II, using a new source of material, color film. Color film was seldom used in documenting the war, but it provides a very different perspective from the more common black and white coverage. Part 1, which airs on May 21st, looks at the rhetoric of ideology and extremism that erupted in armed conflict. Part 2, scheduled for May 22nd, deals with the war itself. Also on May 21st, the History Channel will show Codes, a history of the development of the science and language of secret communication from ancient Egypt to cyberspace. While on May 22nd, along with the second part of World War II in color, you can see The Lost City of Atlantis, an examination of the many centuries of myths about that fabled lost continent, as well as some contemporary speculation as to whether it really existed. Be sure to check your local listings for the exact showtimes of these History Channel programs. And that's it for another week of Talking History. I hope you've enjoyed the show. We invite you to send us your comments or suggestions either by email at talkinghistory@creighton.edu or by U.S. mail to Talking History, care of the Department of History, Creighton University, Omaha, Nebraska, 68178. Until next time, from the studios of KIOS-FM in Omaha, Nebraska, this is Brian LeBeau.
She said, "Tooley, tooley, 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 tulip time." Then they talked, yes, they talked about the weather. Catchy, catchy, catchy. Their heads were close together, together.